Faith seems central to any forum or conference on religion or theology. In fact, later today we're going to hear a panel discuss the pillars of their faith. Yet we often find ourselves very confused and bewildered about the meaning and significance of this word faith. Nietzsche said in The Antichrist, "Faith means not wanting to know what is true." And Mark Twain, quoting a schoolboy, has said, "Faith is believing what you know ain't so." Well, our speaker this morning would not share these rather cynical and cryptic comments on faith. And I think he would also carefully and convincingly differentiate faith from belief. He's devoted most of his professional life to studying the phenomenon of faith and its universal place in the lives of mankind. I think most of us would generally agree that the Sunstone Conferences are bringing together a collection of individuals deeply committed to exploring the dimensions and the evolution of their personal faith. Our speaker, Dr. James Fowler, has, in a very exciting way, elevated the word faith from a noun to a verb. He sees faith as a way of a person's leaning into it and making sense of his own life. Every one of us who chooses to go on living is operating in some stage of basic faith. He has, through careful research, mature scholarship, and insight, demonstrated that faith is not static, but rather is a dynamic system that goes through recognizable stages as we proceed through life. Dr. James W. Fowler comes to us from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, where he serves as a professor of theology and human development and is the director of the Center for Faith Development at the Candler School of Theology. He has degrees in history from Duke University, in theology and ethics from Drew University, and a PhD in religion and society from Harvard in 1961. He's taught at Harvard University and at Boston College. He's internationally known and has lectured extensively in the United States and abroad. In addition to 6 books, he's authored numerous articles and papers on the subject of faith and human development. He's an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church, and his wife is also professionally engaged in theology. She's not here with us today, but she works as the director of Children and Family Ministries in the Methodist Church at Atlanta, Georgia. So now we're very pleased to hear from Dr. James Fowler.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stout. That quote from Nietzsche reminded me of one of my favorite pieces of graffiti in one of the bathrooms at the Widener Library in Harvard University. You've seen it other places. "God is dead, Nietzsche." Underneath it, "Nietzsche is dead, God." Another favorite one from Nietzsche for me was that if you stare into the abyss long enough, the abyss stares back at you. I'm certainly honored to be part of this Sunstone Foundation Conference. In my first trip to Utah, my first trip to Salt Lake City, I very much appreciate the warmth of the welcome that I've received here. I've run into several friends made through writing, and have come to appreciate very much the imagination and the discipline and the work of Peggy Fletcher and her staff as they've put together what appears to me to be one of the most exciting theological conferences that I know anything about. So I'm very glad to be here. As Dr. Stout told you, I have been engaged for the last 10 to 12 years in the study of what has come to be called faith development. This morning I'm going to give you the quick and nasty version of some of our fundamental findings. I put it in that dramatic way because for some of you this will be perhaps illuminating and exciting. I hope that it will drive you or lead you to read some of the things I've written about this in a more considered way. The book Stages of Faith, written in 1981, is perhaps the most comprehensive statement of the kind of position I'm sharing with you this morning. But I have a book going to appear about November 1st with the title Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian, which also has a chapter devoted to our topic for this morning. If you're interested in what I'm doing, I hope you'll get that material and read further before you talk about it. If you find yourself feeling hostile toward what I'm saying, and you feel that this is a heresy that needs to be stamped out, I hope that either you'll keep your mouth shut or also read further, because what I'm giving you this morning, because of time limitations, can at best be a kind of caricature, a kind of painting with broad brushstrokes of what I've found to be extremely complex and difficult to communicate. One of my former students, now herself a very fine teacher of this material, I think in some ways she teaches it much better than I do, said that my problem in trying to teach faith development theory is that I never had to learn it. And those who've had to learn it can perhaps teach it better than those who, in some sense, have been involved in the composition or the creation of the theory. I want to talk with you first, faith as a focus for research. We began our research on faith development on the premise that faith is a human universal. By this we mean that wherever we find human beings, our species is marked by several uniform features and dimensions of struggle and awareness. We are marked by the universal awareness of death, an awareness which we futilely endeavor to keep at an impersonal distance as much and as long as we can. We are marked with the burden of having to make life-defining choices under conditions of uncertainty and risk. Not only is this a matter of insufficient experience or inadequate information, we live, choose, react, and respond under the sentence of what philosophers have called contingency, and under some degree of thraldom to the unknown and the unknowable. Moreover, we human beings live with a disconcerting duality. We have imaginations and intuitions and moments of awakening which disturb us into awareness of dimensions of circumambient reality which we can only name, on our own at least, as mystery. And yet, our feet mire in the clay of everyday toil, getting and giving, spending and being spent in the struggle for survival and meaning. In the midst of contingency, suckled on uncertainty, we spend our blessed and threatened years becoming selves through relations of trust and loyalty with others, persons like ourselves, and the communities of such persons. We attach to each other in love. We struggle with each other in fidelity and infidelity. We share our visions of ultimate destiny and calling. We offer our projections in hope, our moments of revelation in awe, and our fear in numbness and protest. We are language-related creatures. We are symbol-born and story-sustained creatures. We do not live long or well without meaning. That is to say, then, we are creatures who live by faith. We live by forming and being formed in images and dispositions toward the ultimate conditions of our existence. And for at least the last 300 millennia, these images and dispositions have been held within the province of religion. Faith has been religious faith. From the first red ochre and flower-decked cave burials to the Chartres Cathedral, the boundaries which have called for faith have been named and addressed through the mediation of religion. I take religion to be the collective expressions through rite, myth, symbol, ethical teachings, and music, and scriptures of human apprehensions of and by transcending value, power, and truth. Something has happened in the modern period, though, to break this long dependence upon religion as the community and the context for the formation and the transformation of faith. The modern period, at least from what we've come to call the Enlightenment and forward, has been marked by the rise of scientism and by the breakdown, for many persons, of their communal groundings in shared narratives of meaning. secularization, the rise of pluralism, and the vertigo of relativity have cracked and fissured the mosaics of meaning by which whole cultures have been formed and sustained. We've come to recognize that the activity of being and becoming in faith may take forms and struggle for integrity in directions quite other than through cultic or institutional religion. There are secular forms and objects of faith. There are secular communities of faith. There are toward the limiting conditions of human life that are idiosyncratic, if not to say solipsistic. A kind of modern parallel to the situation after the destruction of the biblical Tower of Babel prevails for many persons in our culture. Each person or small subculture struggles to form and maintain a shelter of shared values and lifestyle that will provide protection against the quicksand of meaninglessness and the winds and terrors of cosmic aloneness. In this situation of anomy, this situation of disorientation religiously, for many in our society, narcotization in one form or another has become the solution, a kind of forgetting or ignoring or escape through consumption or distraction of the burdens of our finite vulnerability. Or in the form most favored by a culture that believes its own distorted myths of individualism, there is the effort through the acquisition of stuff, power, or securities of various sorts, or through achievements or relationships, the effort to negate our vulnerability and to outfox fate. Not to outfox faith, however. Now, over the past 10 years, in a variety of settings, I and a team of associates that has changed over the years have conducted in-depth, semi-clinical interviews with something approaching 500 persons. Among other interests, we have sought to test whether certain developmental patterns which seem to hold in the domain of cognitive, psychosocial, and moral growth have developmental parallels in this area of faith. Our underlying questions have been the following. How do persons awaken to and begin to form and be formed in life stances of trust and loyalty, of belief and commitment, that carry them into the force fields of their lives? Are there predictable stages or revolutions in the life of meaning-making? Must we, in order to become fully adult and fully human, have a deep-going and abiding trust in and loyalty to some cause or causes greater in value and importance than ourselves? Now let me report some of the findings of this research. In the analysis of these faith development interviews, which may last up to 3 hours with adults, we have found suggestive grounds for proposing a sequence of stage-like ways of being in faith in order to describe a general pattern of development. These stages, which try to describe uniform and predictable ways of being in faith, are not, in the first instance, matters of the contents of faith. We've included in our sample persons from a wide variety of religious background, Christian, Jewish, non-Christian, and a number of persons who would account for their faith in very secular terms. We're not talking first about the contents or the what of faith, but rather the how of faith, the operations of knowing and valuing by which people commit themselves and develop a style of life individually or in community. We are not suggesting that a person goes through a succession of worldviews and value systems, if we mean by those terms substantive beliefs, themes, images, and stories of faith. Rather, we are trying to identify and communicate differences in the styles, the operations of knowing and valuing that constitute the action, the way of being, that is faith. The stages we've identified describe in formal terms the structural features of faith as a way of construing, interpreting, and responding to the factors of uncertainty, finitude, and ultimacy in our lives. Let's look at the stages of faith. We've identified seven. The first we call primal faith. We start as infants, you and I. Someone picks us up and wipes off our afterbirth and provides a nipple with a breast or a bottle, and we are launched as human beings. Prior to the event of birth itself, we have enjoyed one of the most remarkable of symbiotic relationships. Somatically, through our bodies, we likely have already derived from our life in the womb some sense of whether the world that was has meaning or purpose, and whether it intended and rejoices in our presence, or whether we come as intruders. Birth itself is a trauma. Students of the birth process tell us that even in the 20-minute passage through the birth canal in a normal birth, we nearly smother. There is a threat of negation in our emergence into life. We are bruised and squeezed into life. We gasp our way into community. During the first year of life, the mutual tasks of baby and caring others involve bonding and attachment, and the generation of a trusting give and take. Such a wondrous process. The baby's early efforts at relating and making self at home have the effect, when things go well, of recruiting tenderness and of mobilizing energetic care. In the mutuality of need and the need to be needed, the baby forms a rudimentary but deep sense of the rhythms of intimacy and of the texture of the environment. Without a reflexive sense of selfhood yet, the baby nonetheless, in the undifferentiated state that my colleague Ulrich Neisser calls the ecological self, the baby begins to wrap the coils of centration around primal images of the felt goodness or badness of self-world. Basic trust versus a sense of basic mistrust, Eric Erickson named it. The struggle is for some balance of trust in the worth and the irreplaceability of the self and in the reliability of the environment made up of those in whose eyes and under whose care the mirrored self has begun to gather. Paul Tillich called our inevitable sense of vulnerability to dropping out of being ontological anxiety, the anxiety that comes with being and with the threat of non-being. Primal faith arises in the roots of confidence that find soil in the ecology of relations, of care, and of shared meanings that welcome a child and offset our profound primal vulnerability. The first symbols of faith are likely to take primitive form in the baby's hard-won memories of maternal and paternal presence. As dependable realities which go away, but which can be trusted to return, our primary caregivers constitute our first experiences of superordinate power, wisdom, and dependence. These primal others are doubtless present in their mixtures of rigidity and grace, of arbitrary harshness and nurturing love, in the images of God, which take more or less conscious form by our fourth or fifth years. There's a wonderful book by Anna Maria Rizzuto, a Roman Catholic psychoanalyst, called The Birth of the Living God, which goes in much greater depth into the thesis that I've so quickly offered and passed over. Let's go to a next stage we call intuitive projective faith. Intuitive projective faith. At about age two, a revolution begins to happen for the child. Language emerges to mediate relations to the world and to others in new ways. Important preparation for this emergence has gone on in the interchanges between the child and those providing primary care, where, as videotapes of mothers and their babies interacting show, each is teaching the other to talk. In my astonishment, I saw that the mother imitates the vocal sounds and the facial expressions of the baby as much as the baby imitates those of the mother. The mother's imitations of the facial expressions and vocal experiments of their babies seem to provide a crucial mirror, both visually and vocally. And as the child matches the sound, matches sounds and objects, he or she gains new leverage in communication and in the interpretation of the world. Language makes possible a qualitatively new reflectiveness on the environment and a qualitatively new reflexive with regard to the self. In my book, Stages of Faith, I tell about the experience we observed with our daughter, age 15 months or so, awaking each morning to exercise her very limited but growing vocabulary to name the world. It was a very important ritual for starting the day and seemed to be her exhilaration at the discovery of the power of language to name and sort out reality without having to point or handle it. And that then made it possible for her to begin to reflect upon herself in a qualitatively different way, because she too had a name like the objects that she was naming to reconstitute the world each morning. The child, now able to walk freely and to question everything, daily encounters novelties and newness. Whether we remember the vividness of our daily and nightly delights and terrors at ages 3, 4, or 5, or whether we have access to it only by observing others now in childhood, we know that the active, inquiring mind of the child will never again be so free and fresh regarding preformed constructions. Perception, feelings, and imaginative fantasy make up the child's principal ways of knowing and of transforming his or her experiences. The ordering tendencies of logical operations will come later. For now, stimulated by experience and by stories and symbols and examples, children form deep and long-lasting images that hold together their worlds of meaning and wonder. I'm going to give you a statement in just a moment that never could have been said quite this way by a child, but it's my effort to capture in words the experience that children share with us when we interview them about their ways of making meaning in the age range that I've been talking about. "I feel like I am the center of the world," says our hypothetical child. "Everything important to me is there because of me, to be for me. When we travel at night, the moon follows just our car. Flowers are there to smell with, and stars are there to fly to. Sometimes I have scary dreams at night. They are right there in my room. If you were in the room with me, you could see them too. Sometimes during the daytime, I think about things like are in my dreams. Sometimes they make me scared. I wonder sometimes where heaven is and what being dead means. If it's like a monster taking people away, or if it hurts, or if mommy and daddy will be with me. What happened to our pet bird the neighbor's cat got? My friend told me that the devil will come up out of a hole in the ground and get me if I'm not careful. So now I won't play in the backyard by myself. I think about God a lot. I think God must be like the air, everywhere. Can God see me? Will God help keep our house from catching fire? Is Granddad with God? Where's that?" Here we see the intuitive, projective child's awakening to the mystery of death. We see the awakening to a world of reality beyond, around, and penetrating the everyday. We see lively imagination grasping the world, endeavoring to give it unity and sense. The preschool child who has access to the symbols, the stories, and the shared liturgical life of a religious tradition awakens to an expanded horizon of meanings. Though such symbolism or symbols in their archetypal power can be used, as was the imagery of the devil in the episode I reported, these symbols also enrich the child's stores of meaning and can provide powerful identifications and aspirations, as well as sources of guidance and reassurance. Bruno Bettelheim's wonderful book, The Uses of Enchantment, about the importance of fairy tales for children in this age, is a powerful correlative sort of statement to what I've been sharing with you. Let's go to another stage that characteristically begins to appear at or around the time a child begins schooling, 6 or 7. Part of the groundwork for this revolution, which we call the transition to mythic literal faith, Part of the groundwork for this revolution relates to the development of what Jean Piaget, the Swiss-French student of cognitive development, has called concrete operational thinking, a revolution in the way the child orders and understands his or her experience of the world. Stable categories for understanding space and time and causality emerge at this time to make the child's constructions of experience much less dependent upon feeling and fantasy. The child is now able to reverse processes of thought and to coordinate more than one feature of a situation at a time. This means that the world becomes for the child a more linear, orderly, and predictable place. Children in this stage routinely take the perspectives of others on matters of mutual interest, and they recognize others' perspectives as being different than their own. Have you ever thought about the fact that one cannot tell a story or write a letter without being able to take the perspective of the one to whom one is writing or to whom one is telling the story? We don't come into the world automatically able to do that. That skill emerges around age 7 or 8 as a consistent part of our cognitive repertoire. This means that children now can develop a strong sense of fairness based on moral reciprocity. We should be punished for what we do that's wrong. We should be rewarded for what we do that is right. And often this leads for children to the elevating of the associations of reward for doing good and punishment for doing bad to the level of a cosmic principle in their own thinking about right or wrong or good or evil, and in their construction of an image of God. They may never be taught that God operates like a wise and prudent parent, but they construct God that way, as rewarding us when we do good, punishing us when we do evil. Later, that belief, that construct, comes to a sad end for many children in what we call 11-year-old atheism, when they find that it doesn't always work that way. Faith in this stage becomes a matter of reliance on the stories, the rules, and the implicit values of the family's community of meanings, where the family or its substitute is related to a larger community of shared traditions and meanings. Faith involves valuing the stories, the practices, and the beliefs of that tradition. Narrative, or story, is the important idea here. With the abilities to take the perspectives of others, and with a much improved grasp of causal relations and consequences, narrative seems to be the favored and the most powerful way of gathering and expressing personal and shared meanings. Knowing the stories of our people becomes an important index of identification and the evaluation of self and others and their groups. The ability to create classes based on distinguishing characteristics of objects or groups makes these kinds of identifications and exclusions important matters in this stage. It's interesting to watch a child go through the phase where he can't be quite clear how one could be a United Methodist and a Democrat and an American all at the same time. But that's no problem at age 8 or 9. No political editorial intended in that example. Let me give you a flavor from a hypothetical child of 8 or 9, this one actually is about 10, who will give us a window into the world of the mythic literal way of making meaning. You ask me who I am, I'll tell you. I am Robert Kelleher, the son of Tom and Diane, and the brother of Kristen and Kevin. Do you want me to tell you about all of my grandparents and cousins too? No? Well, I'm a member of Mrs. Kate's fourth grade class at Hawthorne School, and I'm the third best soccer player in my grade after Donald Pruitt and Teddy Jackson. Oh yes, I go to Christ the King Parish. My scout troop meets there. It's Troop 27, Cub Scouts, that is. Well, that's about it. Yes, he continues, I believe in God. What is God like? Well, I guess God is like Jesus, sort of. We believe that God is like in three parts, Father, Son, and Spirit, Holy Spirit. But I picture God mostly as Jesus. But sometimes I sort of think of God as an old man and sort of like a judge or a ruler. Yes, God made us and loves us and wants us to love each other. I think the worst thing God doesn't like is all the nuclear bombs. I would like to tell all the presidents of the world, don't use those bombs. Let us grow up. Let the earth, the grass, and all of the animals continue to live. The most important thing, he continues, is not to tell lies and to stick up for your friends if they need help. Like when my best friend Roger got into trouble last week. The teacher who monitors the hall thought that, well, you see, this locker got broken into and some stuff was stolen from it, and the hall teacher thought she saw Roger taking some stuff from the broken locker, and he did have a Walkman just like the one that was stolen. So the principal called him in because they thought Roger did it. Roger didn't deserve that. Well, I went straight to the principal and I told him it was not Roger, that he already had a Walkman that he got for his birthday, and besides, that Roger would never steal anything. The principal really listened to me, and he and the teacher apologized to Roger. In these statements, we hear something of the concreteness and the literalness of this boy's appropriation of his community's beliefs. We also see that he does not construct either his sense of himself or of others in terms of personality or inner feelings and reflectiveness. Persons are defined by their affiliations and by their actions. He speaks to us from in the midst of the flowing stream of his life, without stepping out onto the bank to reflect on its overall direction or meanings. He does not yet have what I call a story of his stories. His poignant statement about the threat of nuclear warfare is, I'm sad to say, powerfully typical of our interviews with children in this stage. We do from time to time encounter adults whose ways of structuring their faith have features very similar to those of Robert. A substantial number of adolescents share his way of constructing their images of self and others and ultimate environment. From this stage on, I'm trying to alert you, we are dealing with ways of being in faith that can typify adults as well as age groups, the age groups where they most typically have their rise. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over a passage on stage transitions. But that if you're catching on to what I'm talking about in terms of these stages, you'll see that these are the ways of making meaning that characterize us at different periods of our lives, and you may begin to sense that the transition from one such stage to another can be a time where we experience varying degrees of dislocation and confusion, a kind of being out of one's mind as one develops a new way of being in faith. So that doubt and struggle, as we move from one stage to another, are characteristic experiences, and transitions can be more or less lengthy and problematic times in our life. And I think one of the contributions and implications of this work is that doubt and struggle of that sort is not necessarily something to be avoided in the life of faith, but in fact, the deepening and the growth in the life of faith does require such times of dislocation and struggle. Now let's turn to a stage that emerges typically in the era of adolescence. We call this synthetic conventional faith. A key to understanding the structure and the dynamics of this stage is an appreciation for another revolution that adolescence typically brings in cognitive development, in our ways of thinking. Informal operational thinking, and this is Piaget's term again, informal operational thinking, the mind takes wings. No longer is it limited to the mental manipulation of concrete objects or representations or of observable processes. Now thinking begins to construct all sorts of ideal possibilities and hypothetical considerations. Faced with the challenging of developing the perfect mousetrap, the formal operational mind doesn't limit itself to modifying or perfecting the types of mousetraps it has seen. But it starts with the fundamental problem of disposing of a household pest and imagines a great variety of ways that the problem might be solved. Imagination, one writer has said, is intelligence at play. Formal operational thinking makes possible the generation and the use of abstract concepts and ideals. It makes it possible to think in terms of systems. And it enables us to construct the perspectives of others on ourselves, to see ourselves as others see us. Part of the confusion and the difficulty of adolescence can be traced to the new self-consciousness, which I've summed up in the following poetic doggerel. I see you seeing me. I see the me I think you see. And pretty soon, as I begin to see the me that I think you see, it turns around And I know that you see you according to me. You see the you think I see in our interpersonal relationships. That is to say, at the transition to adolescence, we begin to be acutely self-conscious with regard to how others are constructing us. St. Augustine, in his Confessions, recognized and said, "And I became a problem to myself. I began to develop a burdensome self-consciousness." It also means that any time we're in conversation, there are at least six of us who are talking or interacting with each other. Anytime two of us are talking, there are six images of the self at play there. I'll let you figure that out for yourself. In the term synthetic conventional, I'd like to say a word or two about why I use the term synthetic. It does not mean artificial. Rather, it means pulling together and drawing disparate elements into a unity, a synthesis. In the name of this stage, the drawing together in question is a twofold synthesis. First, due to the rich new possibilities of interpersonal perspective taking, the young person now has available a variety of reflections or mirrorings of the self. In every significant face-to-face relationship, he or she has access to someone's construction of the self he or she is becoming. Like distorting mirrors in an amusement park funhouse, the images of self which one discerns that others have constructed do not necessarily fit nicely together, nor are they necessarily congruent with one's own felt images of self. Synthesis in the first instance, then, means a drawing together and integration into oneness of that viable sense of unity in selfhood that we've come to call identity. The other aspect of synthesis, crucial to the forming of the synthetic conventional stage of faith, has to do with the drawing together of one's stories, values, and beliefs into a supportive and orienting unity. In this stage, a person struggles with composing a story of my stories, a sense of one's life meaning, generally taken, and of the meaning and purpose of his or her life in particular. Our research suggests that this involves a process of drawing together into an original unity a selection of the values, the beliefs, and the orienting convictions which are made available to the adolescent through his or her significant face-to-face relationships. Although each person's worldview synthesis in this stage is in some degree unique, we describe it as conventional for two important reasons. First, it is a synthesis of belief and value elements which are derived from one's significant others. The elements themselves, then, are conventional, although they may be formed into a novel, individual configuration. Secondly, it is a synthesis of belief and value which has, at this stage, what the philosopher Michael Polanyi calls a tacit character as opposed to an explicit character. The philosopher Santayana once said, "We cannot be sure who discovered water, but we can be certain it was not the fish." And why is that? Because water is the very medium of life for the fish, and the fish would have to leap out of the fish tank in order to inquire into the properties of water as an object separate from the self. That's a vivid way of describing a tacitly held set of beliefs and values. I have formed them. They sustain my sense of selfhood. I am passionately ready to defend them, but I have not yet separated myself from them so as to be able to give you a systematic, reflective account of the values I hold. Here's a composite statement from a 15-year-old girl that might give you an example of what this way of being in the world feels like. "My life is so full of people," she says, "and it seems like all of them want something special from me. Start with my best friend. She wants me to spend at least an hour a day on the telephone with her. She would like it if we sat together in all of her classes and ate lunch together every day. Her parents are moving toward a divorce. She doesn't have a boyfriend, and all of her brothers and sisters have left home. But that's just the beginning. There's Sam. He's my boyfriend, and he's a year older than I. He wants me to spend all of my time between classes and at lunch with him. And then he wants to bring me home from school every day and then talk on the phone every night. We fight a lot, not about your usual thing, who's jealous of whom and so forth, but about beliefs and values. He tries, but he comes from a family where male chauvinism reigns supreme. He is the last child and the first son, and he's always been spoiled terribly. Then he has this romantic nonsense about chivalry and male honor and superiority. We argue and debate and even shout at each other on the phone. Then there's my parents. Since my older sister went off to college, we've been very close. I know that they have high expectations of me. Even though they don't say too much about it directly, they always ask questions like, how was your day? How did your test go? How are things with Sam? And so on. They don't mean it to be pressure, but it does make me feel that there are a lot of demands on me. Then there are my teachers, my friends at church, my flute teacher, my grandparents, and my sister. All of them, in one way or another, want a piece of me, or they represent some set of demands I make on myself. And yet, I wonder if any of them really know me. I don't think any of them know really about my relation to God. I don't think of God as an old man or even a person like anymore. Instead, I have this deep feeling that God is kind of a friend, a presence that loves me and cares for me and really knows me. God knows me, my present me, and my future me, even better than I know myself. When I wake up early in the mornings, 5 a.m. most mornings, to study, in the loneliness and the tiredness, there is God. When I feel on the outs with my parents or Sam or my friends, there is God. When I feel that I will never be good enough in math and chemistry to get into veterinarian school, there is God. I don't speak of God as He anymore. In the Apostles' Creed, I say Maker instead of Father. But other than that, I think my church's teachings about God are true and good, especially my teacher, Mr. Martin. He knows so much, and he has so much enthusiasm, and he makes it all so clear. I just wish my church lived up to all it knows. It's important to recognize that many persons, many adults, come to equilibrate or balance or arrest in the synthetic conventional stage. The worldview and the sense of self drawn together in this stage, and the authorities who confirm one's values and beliefs, are internalized, and the person moves on through the life cycle with a set of tacitly held, strongly felt, but largely unexamined beliefs and values. Our 15-year-old girl, quoted in the statement that I've just read, gives evidence already that she will likely make another transition in her faith and identity in her early adulthood, the transition which we call the move to individuative, reflective style of faith. I'm conscious that I've reached and exceeded the magic hour that we're supposed to break up. We were a bit late getting started. I will try to condense the latter parts of this so that we won't be much longer. As you can see, we're about halfway through the life cycle, which is a dangerous place to stop. I want to speak now about individuative, reflective faith, a stage that begins to emerge typically in young adulthood, though I remind you that we have adults who remain with the mythic literal stage or the synthetic conventional stage. The rise of individuative reflective faith is occasioned by a variety of experiences which make it necessary for persons to objectify, examine, and make critical choices about the defining elements of their identity and faith. Two fundamental movements are at the heart of the transition that this stage represents. First, there must be a shift in a sense of the grounding and the orientation of the self. We move from a definition of the self derived from one's relations and roles and the network of expectations that go with them to a new kind of self that must be newly self-authorized. One way to summarize this is to say this movement toward what I call the executive ego arises out of my asking the question, who am I when I'm not defined by being my parents' son, when I'm not defined by being so-and-so's spouse, or when I'm not defined by the job I do or the roles I play? Is there an I that is separable from the I that knows itself in all of those relations? This is not to negate those relations, but it's to say that one's executive ego, one's identity, is not subsumed or defined by any one of those particular roles or relations. Secondly, just as we get clearer about the boundaries of the self, the movement in this stage requires, or to this stage requires, a critical reflection upon the beliefs, values, lifestyle, and community affiliations that will define one's life. Recently, I talked with a rabbi who was commenting on the difference between the experience of young Orthodox Jews who had never looked at the perspectives of others seriously enough that they became disembedded from their own orthodoxy, as compared with those who had done that kind of critical reflection on why they were Orthodox Jews. Two very different ways of being. And the individuative reflective stage involves that dangerous but exhilarating experience of disembedding from the worldview one has formed and critically reflecting upon it and appropriating it so that one can explicitly account for what one believes and to what one is committed. I think perhaps you begin to get a feel of that stage. I must move on without giving you the example I had prepared to a discussion of another stage that typically emerges at or about midlife, a stage we call conjunctive faith. Think about individuative reflective as the separation of the self from others so that a certain clarity about identity can occur. Think of conjunctive faith as a rejoining in which individuality is maintained, but also genuine participation is renewed. Conjunctive comes from the holding together of seeming opposites in our lives. Let me try to explain a little more. If the integrity of the individuative reflective stage is based upon a clear sense of reflective identity, a firm set of ego boundaries, one might say that the conjunctive stage, as far as selfhood concerns, requires the development of what I've come to call an ego leak. If we've formed firm, hard boundaries on a sense of identity, we now have to recognize that the conscious sense of who we are is only part of who we are, that conscious egoic sense of self-awareness. And in fact, we are that sense of consciousness rests upon a much deeper self, and a new kind of permeability between the unconscious and the conscious mind has to become integrated into our ways of being as adults. What brings about this sort of awareness? Many experiences, too many to talk about today. But chief among them, I think, is the cluster of experiences that come with reaching midlife. I am a recently newly initiated authority on this experience. By the time we come to midlife, we've had to deal with a new sense of the reality and the power of death. Peers and some who are younger than we have died. Perhaps our parents and many of their generation have died. One recognizes that he or she may have lived more than half of an expectable lifetime, and the unmistakable signs of irreversible aging are both felt and visible. One's children may now be teenagers or young adults, and one probably feels the full weight of being a member of the bridge generation, the linking group between the elders who are gradually passing off the scene and the youth who are just beginning to seek and find their entering point in being the generation of the future. What has to be held together in this new orientation of conjunctive faith are several kinds of polar tensions in our lives. Think about these polarities. The polarity of being both old and young. The polarity of being both masculine and feminine. The polarity of holding together the realization that we are both constructive and well-meaning persons, and that in some degree we are also destructive and pernicious beings, despite our best intentions. St. Paul coupled this, held this together very nicely in Romans 7, when he said, "The good that I would do, I do not, and the very evil I would not do, I find myself doing. Who will deliver us from this body of death?" By the time we've become middle-aged, we've had to recognize that sometimes by our very being, we are a threat or wounding to other persons. It means coming to terms, as Carl Jung said, with our shadow self. Another feature of conjunctive faith that seems important to lift up in this somewhat rushed and truncated version is that in conjunctive faith, we begin to understand that truth is multiplex and many-sided. You may remember your excitement in discovering in high school physics that light, the behavior of light, requires two different and unreconcilable models to account for its behavior, one based on packets of energy and one based upon wave phenomenon. Both are required to understand the phenomenon. They can't be integrated into one theory. Truth is multiform and has a paradoxical character. This means then that in our ways of being in faith in the conjunctive stage, there is a curious and powerful combination of being deeply rooted in one's own particular tradition and commitments and convictions, but at the same time having a disciplined openness to the truths and convictions of others. I've seen this quality illustrated beautifully in the Sunstone Conference this morning as I've attended sessions. Deep and particular identification in many instances with the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and at the same time a disciplined openness to perspectives on that experience from other traditions, other religious traditions, as well as other social scientific traditions. I wish there were time to read our example from this stage. I think it would make it more vivid for you. But I must say a word in closing about the last stage we've identified, a stage that we call universalizing faith. There's a kind of tensional or paradoxical quality about the previous stage, which for some persons seems to get released as they move beyond it to a new level and depth of commitment. The movement toward universalizing faith, relatively rare in our research and in any culture, is marked by the radical completion of two tendencies that have been developing throughout all of the previous stages. These two tendencies involve, first, a kind of decentration from self. I spoke about the child at the beginning who said that the moon follows only our car. That's an interesting kind of egocentrism. Everything exists for me. We spoke about the gradual taking of the perspective of others. With each new stage, there is a widening of the range of those whose perspective is taken and included and valued alongside one's own or one's group's own perspective. At the stage of universalizing faith, there is a decentration from self as the basis for knowing the world and a recentration in God or in the transcendent beyond. And seeing that in that recentration in God, not only is my perspective taken account of, but the perspective of all other beings is as well. A kind of self-emptying then regarding the vantage point from which we make sense of the world. And the second movement is related to that, a kind of decentration as regards the position from which one values other persons, objects, institutions in the world. Let me tell you a quick story that will illustrate what I'm trying to talk about here. I was in the fourth grade. We had moved to a new town, and one of the first persons I met was Tommy McBrayer. Tommy McBrayer was an only child, attractive lad, but very used to having his own way about things. And I don't know why, but Tommy McBrayer and I got put at loggerheads very quickly. And one of the rare instances that I can remember in my life when a kind of pernicious desire to do him damage began to dominate my awareness. And it disturbed me so much that I would wake up in the morning sometimes thinking that maybe today was the day we had to have this final showdown and I had to put this upstart kid in his place. One morning when I was thinking those kind of dismal thoughts, it dawned on me that Tommy McBrayer had a mother and father who loved him as much and in the same way as my mother and father loved me. And that awareness, so new and so strange, did something to my desire to damage Tommy McBrayer. Suddenly I had to perceive him as one who, though I hated, parents loved divinely. And it was my first experience, I think, consciously, of the kind of decentration that I'm talking about, where one begins to value as God values and to see other human beings, all human beings, as valued sons and daughters of God, even as we are valued sons and daughters of God. I was very grateful that that insight came to me before we had our conflict, because the next year, Tommy McBrayer contracted polio and for a year and a half was in an iron lung and near death. And I would have felt terrible had I done what I anticipated. Now, I'm talking about, at a cosmic scale, something paralleling that learning to love Tommy, not because I found him lovable, but because he was loved by those beyond himself. I'm going to conclude my remarks with a set of quotes from a person who represents this sort of orientation that we call universalizing faith, a person who I think may be recognized by you as I read it. There comes a time when an individual becomes irresistible and his action becomes all-pervasive in its effect. This comes when he reduces himself to zero. For a nonviolent person, the whole world is one family. He will thus fear none, nor will others fear him. It is not nonviolence if we merely love those that love us. It is nonviolence only when we love those. I know how difficult it is to follow this grand law of love, but are not all great and good things difficult to do? Love of the hater is the most difficult of all, but by the grace of God, even this most difficult thing becomes easy to accomplish if we want to do it. By detachment, I mean that you are not to worry whether the desired results follow from your action or not, so long as your motive is pure, your means correct. Really, it means that things will come right in the end if you take care of the means and leave the rest to God. The last 18 verses of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, give in a nutshell the secret to the art of living. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the sacred scriptures of the Hindus. It says, when you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession, which, when thwarted, burns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment and robs you of the power to learn from past mistakes. Lost is the discriminative faculty, and your life is utter waste. But when you move amidst the world of sense, freed from both attachment and aversion, there comes the peace in which all sorrows end, and you live in the wisdom of the self. He is forever free who has broken out of the ego cage of I and mine to be united with the Lord of love. This is the supreme state. Attain thou this and pass from death to immortality. That's the end of the passage from the Gita. Two more brief passages from our informant. Love never claims, it ever gives. Love ever suffers, never resents, never revenges itself. Have I that nonviolence of the brave in me? My death alone will show that. If someone killed me and I died with prayer for the assassin on my lips, and God's remembrance and consciousness of his living presence in the sanctuary of my heart, then alone would I be said to have had the nonviolence of the brave. These foregoing quotes from the writings of Mahatma Gandhi and from the Bhagavad Gita provide fitting expressions for one version of universalizing faith. I could have used examples from Buddhist, Christian, or Jewish sources, or indeed from other traditions. Universalizing faith in its authentic form is recognizable in any culture or tradition. Despite differences in the metaphysical convictions and the imagery used to express them, and despite differences in their understandings of the relation of being and time, the quality of the lives of persons of universalizing faith, of whatever time or tradition, are demonstrably similar in spirit and in power. This concludes my formal remarks about these stages. Dr. Stout has said that we may announce that for those of you who have the stomach for it,